Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
2020 is almost over. Three great challenges this year to the United States. COVID-19, the pandemic's death toll and its impact on every aspect of American life. Protests and the beginning of a reckoning over racial justice. A presidential election and the profound stress test to American democracy. But there's also a light at the end of the long 2020 tunnel. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci getting his COVID vaccine.
As a symbol to the rest of the country that I feel extreme confidence in the safety and the efficacy of this vaccine, and I want to encourage everyone who has the opportunity to get vaccinated so that we could have a veil of protection over this country that would end this pandemic.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, we'll look back with friends of the show on 2020, the pandemic, protests, and of course, politics. Stephen Henderson joins us. He's host of WDET's Detroit Today and executive editor of Bridge Detroit. He's also out now with the new season of his podcast, Created Equal. Stephen, welcome back to On Point.
Happy holidays, Meghna. Great to be with you.
Happy holidays to you. Rose Scott also joins us. She's host of Atlanta's midday news program, Closer Look, which airs on WABE. Rose, it's so good to have you back on the show.
Same here. Season's greetings.
Season's greetings to both of you. I'm going to start off with what I thought was a sign this morning in my household. Unfortunately, I know I shouldn't, but I use my phone as my alarm clock in the morning. So my phone alarm goes off this morning and I like hit the phone. I don't know what happened, but then the phone auto-dialed 911. And then there's this like terrible beeping noise. It's auto-dialing 911. I like scramble to turn it off. Then the police call me back because they're like, we just got a 911 hang up from this number. Are you okay? And I was like, I think my phone is crying out for help. It's done with 2020.
Everybody needs help now.
Even my phone is like, take me over across to 2021. So, I mean, do you kind of feel that way, guys? Are you done with this year?
I don't know about Stephen, but here's what I'll tell you. The gifts I have received so far from close friends might sum it up. I've received 2 bottles of rum, and this morning I received 2 bottles of Chardonnay. Usually I get a lot of socks, but I'm like, okay, y'all, y'all been dealing with me all year. Is this what it's been like? They're like, yeah.
This will help you. Here you go, Rose. Oh, man. Stephen,
I am really trying to lean into the silence now of the last week. Just kind of withdrawing from all of it just because I'm so exhausted, and when I say exhausted, I mean mentally exhausted more than anything else, but also because I'm anticipating that when we come back to work and everything else in January, that we'll be right back where we were, and that the call to all of us then won't be any less urgent or any less taxing.
So let's talk about that fatigue, actually, because I do feel like many, many, many Americans feel a kind of existential fatigue, given all that they've had to endure in 2020. Many of them, far more than I've had to endure, and I feel exhausted too. So tell me a little bit about what your listeners have been telling you as we sort of get to the end of this year. What's been going on with your listeners in Atlanta and Detroit? Rose, I'll start with you.
I think I think exhaustion is a great way to describe what a lot of people have been feeling. And even right now in Georgia, we're still kind of in the mix of this because we have those two U.S. Senate runoffs coming up in a few weeks. So exhaustion is one way. But I think also there is some optimism. Mm-hmm. You know, if optimism is the attitude and hope is sort of the feeling that the emotion that we want to come out of all of this, I think folks are ready for that. Now, look, the new year won't magically erase all of the ills and all of this issues we've dealt with in 2020, but it's what a new year gives us, right? That hope, that optimism that we have a new 365 to try to make things right. And you can keep things cemented in the past, but you also have to think about what do we do to make things better, you know? And most listeners have said to me, yeah, returning back to normal could be great, but for some people, normal wasn't that great to begin with. And we're talking about folks who might be from marginalized communities or folks who might have already been a part of what we call these disparities and these inequities, right? See, all this existed before the pandemic, and I don't know why folks were surprised about all these disparities and inequities because the pandemic amplified that. So returning to normal could be great for some, but for others, their optimism is, I'm hopeful that it doesn't exactly return to whatever that normal was for them because, hey, it was kind of jacked up to begin with. So exhaustion and optimism and hope, I think, is what I'm hearing a lot here in Atlanta.
You know, I promise I won't be this dark all hour, but, you know, this has been a rough couple of weeks here in Detroit, even given how hard the year has been. In the last weeks of the year, we lost the longest serving Wayne County commissioner here in Detroit, a person that anybody who's involved in political or policy life would have known, was very close with our mayor and lots of other politicians. She died. Jewel Ware was her name. She died in mid-December. And then last week, we lost the Wayne County Sheriff, both of them to COVID, of course. And Benny Napoleon was his name, a guy who had been a Detroit police officer. He had been the Detroit police chief. He ran for mayor a few cycles ago. Again, a real fixture in this community. And of course, we spent time on the show talking about both of them and talking about the fact that we'd lost them and, you know, the difficulty of that, which we've had to do all the year and had to deal with all year. But there was something particularly cruel, I thought, about these two deaths because they came at the same time that we were seeing images of trucks pulling out of the Pfizer plant in West Michigan full of this life-saving vaccine and starting to see video of people getting the vaccine. And it seems in some ways like we're so close to turning a corner and to this looking really different than it has all year. And yet there are people who are still sick. There are people who are still really close to death, and there are people who are still dying. And so we are still kind of steeped in the moment of that yeah. sorrow and anguish that yeah. just will not let up this year. When I say I'm exhausted, it's literally that I don't have anything left in the tank. It's yeah. almost as if I can't conjure the words anymore to describe the level of sorrow that we've been through.
Grief tears away, right? It tears away at unrelenting grief tears away at the soul.
Yes.
And the unrelenting nature of it is especially particular to this year. I mean, Stephen, look, every time we've had you on the show this year, there have been more names.
Yes.
That you've added to the list of people that you and Detroiters have lost every time. And I want to say, like, it is a profoundly human desire to look for that thread of hope on the horizon. I do it too. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge the darkness between now and journeying towards that thread of hope. And to me, one of the big takeaways from this year is, first of all, none of it, quote unquote, needed to happen. But it all did happen. And the question is, okay, so this is one of those like punctuated moments in history. So what are we going to do now, right? Mm. What kind of country are we going to become now? What are the decisions that we will make collectively as a nation of 330 million people about who we want to be? And I think this year was the thing that will precipitate the most important period in modern American history, because we get to decide. But I'm not sure I'm confident in what those decisions might be next year and the year after. So I kind of land at the end of this year with this sense of hope and profound uncertainty. I mean, Rose, do you kind of feel that?
You know, history tells us, Meghna, that, you know, as a nation, how we react or how we respond, how we rebound from signature events has always sort of laid the foundation for what the expectation is. The Civil War, the Great Depression, Civil Rights Movement, 9/11, and now this pandemic. So for me as a journalist in all these conversations that I have every day for Atlanta, I'm not necessarily, I don't want to add to the doom and gloom, mm-hmm. but I also have to be realistic for them too as well. So in having all these conversations and curating all these conversations, are what we try to do is we try to bring people together to look at the issue, look at what are the actionable outcomes are to create a better quality of life for people. You know, that's what we do. That's what we do every day here on Closer Look. Some people may not like it because they say, as a journalist, you're not supposed to do that. Well, why not?
Yeah.
If you want me just to report all the bad stuff, you know, you're going to have a very angry host every day. You know, Stephen talked about the exhaustion and being tired. We're human as well, right?
Right.
I've lost 3 family members in within the 12 months here. So I don't know if listeners knew it. So my job as a curator of conversations is to maybe bring in the glimmer of hope at the same time being fair.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, Rose. We're going to take a quick break here and come back. We're talking with Stephen Henderson and Rose Scott about this monumental year. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're at the tail end of 2020, and we're looking back across this unique year with Stephen Henderson. He's host of WDET's Detroit Today, joins us from Detroit, Michigan, and with Rose Scott, who is host of Closer Look on WABE in Atlanta. And we put out this call on Twitter to On Point listeners, and we told folks that every day after the show, the On Point team sort of talks about lessons learned from that show and how to move forward. And so we asked folks on Twitter, which, by the way, we're at On Point Radio, what are the big lessons learned for you this year And folks keep sending us your responses because, you know, for example, we heard from Mohita, who said things didn't have to be this way. So many people didn't need to suffer or die. There doesn't need to be so much inequity and violence. We have the ability to change things and need to keep holding decision makers accountable. Our lives and lives of our loved ones are at stake. Rose, I will admit that before the break, when you said you have lost family members this year, I did not know that. I am really sorry to hear that. You want to talk about it a little more?
You know, it's a year today that I lost my brother Antonio, unexpected. And I'm from a family of 10. There were 10 of us for all these years. Antonio passed away this week, a year ago. Then on May 1st of this year, my sister Connie, who was sort of the rock, the core of all our siblings, passed away. And then just a couple of months ago, lost a great uncle. Now, he was 102. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we tell Uncle Willie to soar high with the ancestors. And I say that because understanding that what is at the core of the human spirit, you know, is that we're all emotional, right? I don't care what anybody says. We are all emotional. That's who we are. And for me, when you talked about what have we learned, not that I didn't know this, but what was amplified, and I keep using that word because I think it's a great word, is that in the time of need, in the time of something like a pandemic, much like we saw with some of the other events, people come together and people want to help. I can't tell you how many conversations and how many segments we have had addressing food insecurity and housing affordability. People need those to exist, right? And what are we hearing now that when we get to the other side of this pandemic, whenever that is, or as we go into 2021, you're going to have more people looking for housing. You're going to have more people who just want food. And what I saw here in the Atlanta region, I saw a lot of individuals to organizations, the philanthropic community, the business community, coming together. So if we can do this when it's a pandemic, why can't we do this all the time? I just hosted a community forum on food and security here in Atlanta. And as everyone agreed, we should not be in a nation, this should not be a nation where people are hungry, you know? So if we can come together during this pandemic, then what's the problem when it's not a pandemic, you know? Now, I know there's a whole other segment we could do on that. But it's like it's amplified. We know there are some things we can fix in society. Let's be really clear. There are some things that we can fix. Question is, back to the human spirit, are we going to do it? Or are we going to let policy, you know, and legislation get in the way?
Yeah. This, to me, is one of the big lessons. Because for many people, and sometimes I'll include myself in this group, before 2020, it was kind of easy to look away, right? You could just sort of focus on I could focus on my life and kind of intellectually engage with the truths that you're telling, Rose, but not sort of at that like core level as a like the deep human level. And what 2020 has caused, and for good, I would say, is nobody can look away anymore, right? And so the question that you asked of like, we can fix these problems. Why aren't we? I think becomes ever more urgent because, you know, we can actually just vis-a-vis the pandemic. Like there's good work. You're talking about food insecurity, good work being done, on the ground level in localities. But, you know, we just look to other countries that have handled the pandemic better, who have kept people with roofs over their head and food in their refrigerators, you know, kept them employed, because that is what government needs to do for its people in a time of urgent need. And yet it did not happen as much as it could have here. So that why and what do we do about it is I feel more forcefully motivated to answer that question or seek the answers to that question than I ever have before. And Stephen, I wonder what you think about that. It's just like we can no longer not ask why.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we're at a turning point in some ways, in the ways that people are aware of the things that have been with us for so long and have been highlighted by COVID. This year, I think, turned people's eyes toward things that they were choosing not to see in some cases, right? But in other cases, genuinely did not understand. And, you know, the call from that really is to continue to draw their attention to it and to say, these are things, as Rose says, that in many cases have solutions that are within our grasp. And we have an obligation to be talking now about how to grab those things, how to make that work for our communities. At the same time, I feel like the incredible gap that has, again, not materialized this year, but certainly has been highlighted mm-hmm. in a way that it wasn't before, is going to make that more difficult. There is a real difference of opinion. There's a real difference of approach, and there's a real difference, I want to say, of values in this country that is incredibly vivid right now and is holding us back from being able to have these conversations in the way that leads towards solutions, and is going to be just as difficult going into next year. One of the things that we're doing at Bridge Detroit, the news and engagement organization that I started this year, next year, is writing about bold solutions to the problems that were highlighted by COVID. Things that would really send us in a really different direction if we embraced them. And I'm really excited about that work. I'm really excited about the chance to do that. But I'm also really apprehensive about the idea that it will make any difference, that you really are speaking in a lot of cases to people who just don't believe that those problems should be solved. Mm. And they don't believe that the people who are victims of those problems deserve to have them solved. And I don't know what you do about that. Mm. I don't know where we end up landing as a country together around those questions.
And it's made that much harder because not only do people have very divergent values, as you're saying, but they have divergent truths, right? We're not talking about the same sets of events, right? I mean, the facts are facts, but like people aren't even meeting together on that common field of shared facts anymore. Now, we've got a tweet here, for example, from Jason Bordelon, who says, lessons learned for him, no matter what your view on the quantity of government, all Americans should want quality government. Competence matters and is something we should all agree on. Well, Rose and Stephen, hang on for just a second, because I want to turn for a moment to California. Jackie Fortier joins us from Los Angeles. Jackie's health reporter for KPCC. Jackie, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening along. And we had to talk to you in California because, you know, the umbrella issue of the pandemic is really hurting in California right now. How are things going in L.A.?
I'm having a hard time thinking of a quick way to answer that.
Yeah.
This is the worst the pandemic has ever been in California and in Los Angeles. I could throw a series of numbers at you, but I think the biggest one is in the last week, we've had 180,000 cases of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Los Angeles County. 180,000 cases in 1 week. It took us over 6 months to get to the first 100,000 cases. Our hospitals are overrun. We are out of ICU beds. This is the absolute tipping point in Los Angeles.
So tipping point into what, though, Jackie?
Well, that's a good question. The hospital administrators that I talked to are saying that we're going to have to go fairly soon to a triage type of medicine, meaning that they would just concentrate their care on the people who can survive rather than trying to get, give care to everyone. And I mean, that would really be a staggering turn of events. Nowhere in the United States has had that happen. Even New York City, when they were in their horrible situation last April, when hospitals were overwhelmed, they never even got to that point. Italy did last spring. But that's where we're talking about eventually going in LA County, if we can't get fewer people in the hospitals. But I mean, we just have tens of thousands of cases being diagnosed every day. We're about 15,000 cases daily in LA.
Wow. And are there field hospitals, assistance from federal government, military? What's happening there?
Well, the short answer is some. There's a few field hospitals being stood up. The problem isn't really – it's partially bed space, of course, but it's staff. We just don't have enough healthcare workers. Healthcare workers are, of course, getting sick with the virus because they're people like everyone else. We've had hundreds of healthcare workers die over the course of the pandemic. So there just really isn't the level, especially with ICU staff, where they're really highly trained and they can take care of the very critically ill COVID patients. We don't have enough of them. Our governor, Gavin Newsom, recently put out a call asking for help from Australia and Taiwan to send people. I talked to someone who is the head of Kaiser Permanente in Southern California, which is a large hospital group here, and they said that they were going to bring in some of their staff from Hawaii. And that is a drop in the bucket, but they are so desperate to find staff. And the big difference between LA right now and New York last spring was when New York was the epicenter, everyone came to help. Mm-hmm. There were people who could help. People traveled across the country, and they could also pull from other hospitals in the region. We don't have that luxury. Every single healthcare worker needs to stay at the hospital that they're at because they could be needed, you know, today or tomorrow. It could shift easily.
I have to ask, Jackie, how have you been doing? How has 2020 been for you? I mean, this isn't in LA right now, given everything that you just described. This is not a time of sort of relaxing into the peace of the season. I mean, it's spiking ever more. How have you been doing?
I've been doing okay. Thanks for asking. I started this job about 9 months ago. No, about 10 months ago. So I've only reported on the pandemic in Los Angeles. But before this, I was in Oklahoma, and I've seen, you know, how rural healthcare has been able to handle this. And it's our healthcare system has failed in both urban and rural settings. And it's just been heartbreaking to watch.
Stephen and Rose, do you have a question or observation for Jackie? I mean, I am very, very cognizant that I'm sitting beside two other really great public radio hosts.
No, I think, Jackie, I'm curious, too, because as I was saying earlier, here in the Atlanta region, you know, we saw so many organizations and even individuals just start their own nonprofits or their own organizations on the fly just to help people. Did you see that in LA? Did you see a more collaborative attempt or partnerships to help folks?
Yeah, I think that there has been a lot of effort in that. That's not usually what I cover. I talk to a lot of healthcare workers, so I'm really on more of the front lines of the pandemic. But you're right, there has been a lot of people who have been, you know, making an effort. And like you were talking about earlier, the pandemic has really exacerbated, but also just shown a spotlight on all of the societal problems that we have had. I saw that in stark contrast in nursing homes. You know, we've had huge outbreaks in nursing homes. We have hundreds of outbreaks right now in nursing homes in LA County alone, much less across the nation. Nursing homes have been problem areas for decades, but now people are finally paying attention to why we don't pay nursing home workers enough and why we don't have good infection control. So hopefully there are some lessons learned from this that can be, you know, taken into the future.
You know, I wonder what the dynamic looks like now that there is a vaccine and that people are starting to get it. That's one of the things that I'm really curious about all over the country is, you know, how much hope does that inject into the culture? How much does that change the way people are thinking about not just now, but next week and next month and, of course, next year? Are you seeing healthcare workers or just regular citizens change the way that they are approaching all of this because there really is some hope on the way?
I actually talked to Jun Jha, who is an ICU nurse at one of the largest county hospitals in LA, and he recently got the COVID vaccine, and he's been working for months. And I mean, he told me that it helped, and he felt a little bit safer. But I mean, healthcare workers are just frustrated and exhausted. I mean, it's been months of, you know, working in the ICU, having to explain to family members over the phone because those family members can't come in, that their loved one will likely die, and then walking outside and seeing people not wearing masks, not being safe. I mean, that's what they've been doing for months and months. And it's also gotten to a point we have such widespread transmission that, I mean, you know, 15,000 cases every day, it's a snowballing effect. We're going to have more and more people in the hospitals, you know, in 2021, even more than we have now.
Yeah, that momentum that these surges carry last quite a long time. Well, listen,
exactly.
Jackie Fortier, health reporter for KPCC. Jackie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And to everyone in LA and Los Angeles County, hang in there. Take care of each other. Take care of your friends and neighbors. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, I'm joined by Stephen Henderson. He's host of WDET's Detroit Today and executive editor of Bridge Detroit, and he's with us from Detroit, Michigan. Rose Scott also joins us. She's host of the midday news program Closer Look on WABE. It's Atlanta's NPR station. She's with us from Atlanta, Georgia. And Stephen and Rose are with me. We're trying to just think through what 2020 means and lessons learned that we might carry forward into 2021, which is a question that we asked On Point listeners on Twitter. What are their lessons learned? We're at On Point Radio, by the way, on Twitter. And, for example, someone calling themselves Graves and Doyle says, as an immigration attorney, my lesson learned over the last 4 years and punctuated by 2020 is the importance of fighting for what is right and just and knowing it's a marathon, not a sprint. Well, Stephen and Rose, hang on with me for just another minute or two, because I want to turn now to Portland, Oregon. We talked to Jackie Fortier in L.A. before the break, so now let's go up the coast, up the West Coast to the Pacific Northwest, where Shane Dixon Kavanaugh joins us. Shane's a reporter for the Oregonian newspaper. Shane, welcome to On Point.
Greetings, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we wanted to touch down in Portland because it was one of many cities that also experienced massive waves of protests this year over fighting against racial injustice in this country. And I was wondering if you might sort of give us a picture about what it's been like in Portland over, the past couple of weeks before we talk about what happened there in the summer.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, just over the last couple of weeks, we've had a really interesting sort of development in terms of protests here, where there had been a number of activists and demonstrators who had decided to create sort of an occupation zone across three city blocks in Portland to protect the home of an Afro-Indigenous family that had been in a historically Black neighborhood in Portland for generations and were at risk of losing their home. And this became sort of an armed occupation and standoff that sort of highlighted, you know, the city's history of gentrification, racial iniquity, and also really highlighted sort of the radical activism in Portland that the city is known for.
Wow. So there's a lot right in there, what you just said, Shane. First of all, that radical activism, those activists have both friends and foes in Portland, right? I mean, there isn't sort of a unified opinion about that constant activism that the cities has experienced for quite some time.
Yeah, well, I mean, Portland, even before the election of President Trump, and that really changed dynamics quite a bit too, but Portland's always had sort of a long tradition of what I'd call, you know, radical or militant activism on the left. There are many self-described anti-fascists here, anarchists, socialists, and they've always been very involved in street protests and direct action. That's been going on for decades here. And then within the context of the Trump era, we've also seen the rise of right-wing groups who have come to Portland often to confront or to clash with these more left-leaning progressive types.
And so speaking of those right-wing groups, I think, was it just this week or just a couple of days ago that some people, did they storm or attempt to storm the state house in Salem?
There was a one-day special session in Salem on Monday to address a number of pressing issues here, to expand an eviction moratorium statewide, to provide more relief and aid for coronavirus, and a number of right-wing activists. And a lot of these folks have been coming to Salem frequently to protest on a whole host of issues. And on Monday, what we saw were a number of these individuals attempting, some of them armed, in fact, attempting to enter the state house or storm the state house. They clashed with police. They assaulted journalists. Some of them kicked in doors and windows at the Capitol. It was a pretty ugly scene all around.
Now, of course, this summer, also in Portland, the nation's attention was turned particularly to Portland because of the use of federal law enforcement in downtown Portland against protesters. And, you know, we had the scenes of unmarked vans and officers not wearing any sort of identifying insignia, just arresting people off the street, the nightly protests and massive clashes, and the question of, like, you know, the federal government, was it over reaching its power and jurisdiction against lawful protesters. So that was a very a massive flashpoint this summer. I'm just wondering, Shane, as a last question to you, do you have a sort of a takeaway from all that Portland has experienced this year? So how do you look back on the year?
Well, this year has certainly been like no other, and the protests in Portland sort of captured the attention of the city and the entire nation. And it was constant for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. You know, at times we saw thousands protesting police violence and anti-Black racism take over streets, bridges, and freeways. And as you mentioned, there were thousands opposing the presence of federal forces dispatched to Portland by the President of the United States. We've also seen smaller groups drawing police into physical confrontations outside law enforcement offices and government buildings across the city. There have been folks who've toppled historic statues or vandalized businesses and cultural institutions. And we've also seen the ongoing clashes with some of these right-wing activists that have been occurring in Portland for the last 4 years. And in fact, this led to somebody being fatally shot and killed in downtown Portland over the summer. So a lot of reckoning and unrest and, you know, many of the issues that folks all across the country are grappling with have sort of played out in very dramatic ways here in Portland.
And apparently, from what you told us, they continue to do so. So Shane Dixon Kavanaugh, reporter for The Oregonian, joining us from Portland. Thank you so much, Shane.
Thank you.
So Stephen and Rose, I mean, we just wanted to touch down in Portland a little bit because we also had the use of federal officers there in the summer as a particular flashpoint, as I said earlier. But of course, what the backdrop to all this was the national protests that took place this summer, and millions of people taking to the streets to cry out against police violence and racial injustice. That too was a part of this year, and you know, not unrelated to the truths, not at all unrelated to the truths exposed by the pandemic. So, Stephen, I just wanted to sort of hear your reflections on that part of this year. Stephen, you with us? I'm gonna try to get Stephen back. Rose, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah. So you know, just want to hear your thoughts about that.
You know, the great thing about technology, it has enhanced all of our lives, right? The quality of life for us. And technology has also been this window to the horrific atrocities that have existed a long time in this nation. You know, folks love to quote Thomas Jefferson and Dr. Martin Luther King, right? And the same societal issues, complexity, and I am no way saying that Thomas Jefferson and Dr. Martin Luther King in terms of being in the same type of individuals. We have a whole other conversation about that. But folks always love to quote them about how we should be in society. And technology has been this window to these atrocities that have been going on for a long time. And so when you see Ahmaud Arbery running, not at first running for his life, running for exercise, then you see him gunned down. You see George Floyd saying what people have been saying for a long time, I can't breathe. And we see what happens when Breonna Taylor, someone whose occupation was to save lives, and she's gunned down. So when you see all of this, and for some folks it was eye-opening because you needed technology to show you this? This is not new. You know, the paper showed the horrific outcome of Emmett Till. Photographs have long showed you the lynchings of black bodies swinging from a southern tree. Those who know strange fruit. I just had a conversation about this. So that's nothing new. But for some folks, it was eye-opening. So now there is this convergence of let's all come together and try to do something. Okay, fine. But don't wait till it takes another cell phone video of you seeing somebody else, black or brown, losing their life. If you're going to do the work, do the work. Is it exhausting? Yeah. You know, John Lewis did this for five decades. All right. So for me, it's been, you have this window, people who were shocked to see these deaths. You now have this window, this insight into what a particular community has been dealing with for centuries. So if you're going to be woke, then do something. But don't just be woke in theory. If you're going to do the work, do the work, whatever that work is for you.
Yeah. Stephen, I think I heard you there, right? You back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, I think, you know, one of the things that was really difficult about this year was when all of this turmoil happened, you know, it seemed as though there were a lot of people, as Rose points out, who just weren't aware that this is old. This is not new. This is not just now happening. And, you know, one of the jobs, I think, of those of us who, you know, host shows like these in cities like Atlanta and Detroit, or who write for newspapers or are on television, is to try to provide the context and the history that catches people up, that tells people, here's where all of this comes from. And it connects really strongly to things that have happened before and things that we have told ourselves falsely don't play a role in modern American life. I mean, that's one of the great kind of myths that I think has unfolded over time, is that these are things that are used to happen, or the things that used to happen don't have faces in our modern lives. But the things that we see this year, the things that we saw this year, really remind us that they do, and that they live with us all the time. And if you're African-American, of course, you're way more aware of it because it does affect your life. But we need white America to understand that and to be able to respond to it in a productive way. I also want to just quickly, earlier we were talking about COVID deaths, and I mentioned Jewel Ware, our Wayne County commissioner who passed. She actually did not die of COVID. I just have lumped her in with all of the others that we've had. It's not that we haven't had tremendous loss on that front. I just want to make clear, though, that she was not one of them. She did die earlier this month. But we do need to make plain to people that, you know, the pain and the anguish that you see African Americans suffering right now is the lot that we've had in this country for four centuries now. And there is no disconnect between what happened before and what's happening now.
So we've just got 2 minutes left, and I, of course, could listen to both of you for hours on end. The one thing we haven't talked about head on, and I actually think this is okay, is politics. Because politics is the thread that pulls all of these issues together. And I remember this summer I had a conversation with Reverend Jesse Jackson, and he was describing the great body of America, this organism that the United States is. And he said the marrow in the bone is politics. It's the core. And I just wanted to offer that as a final thought today, because what we have also seen over the course of this year is the divisiveness of those politics and the truth of the fact that voters, by virtue of the act of going to the ballot box, are conferring power onto people who have the ability to make decisions, to what you were saying earlier, to fix the problems that we all know are there. And no matter what your political outlook, we have to protect the democracy that is at the core of that system. Like, we have to protect that. Otherwise, we can't solve any of these problems that we talked about. And to me, I'm just going to wrap up with this thought. That is the thought that gives me both hope, because we know, we've seen how stressed our democracy can become, and also a tinge of concern because it has become so stressed. But I still see that light of hope on the horizon. Rose Scott, host of Closer Look on WABE at Atlanta's NPR station. Rose, thank you, as always, for being with us.
Thank you.
And Stephen Henderson, host of WDET's Detroit Today. Stephen, it's always a privilege. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, happy holidays to you again, Magna.
And happy and peaceful holidays to everyone listening today. We wish you all goodwill. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
So
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.